a long, happy VE Day weekend. Happy Mother's Day weekend. Happy third birthday to the Mark Stein Club. That last one I do know a little about. I'm especially grateful to all you first week founding members who were there in May 2017. And 3 years later, you've decided to re-up for another 12 months. It means a lot to me. It means a lot, particularly at this time, when all over the planet, all kinds of businesses, not just the vulnerable mom and pop businesses, but huge, big multinational corporations are going under because of the strange circumstances in which we find ourselves on this third anniversary of the Mark Stein Club. So I thank you and I welcome you to this show. It's Saturday afternoon in North America. It's Saturday evening in Europe. It's Sunday morning in Asia and the Pacific. I can't really pin it down any more precisely than that because for the first time ever on our Clubland Q&As, we're not live. This is being posted about an hour after I've said it because of the limitations of lockdown. I apologize for that. And I hope that by the time we meet again on our Clubland Q&A, we are back to being live around the planet. Let's get to our questions. Kate Smythe is the doyenne of our Australian club members. And she writes, if communist Russia was considered an existential threat to the West, why wasn't communist China? Douglas Murray recently observed during an interview with John Anderson, we were always on a balancing act with China. We recognize its authoritarian nature. We didn't like it, other than the financial benefit it could bring us. At some point, there is an ethical price to pay for it. There's a price to pay for doing the kind of deals our countries had been willing to do with China. Can our pragmatic approach in recent decades be justified, and is it likely to continue? I'd appreciate hearing your thoughts, Mark. Well, I've always thought this. My view on China has not changed since the 1980s. I don't want everything to be made in China. And I've said that, and I've said it in The Spectator, and I've said it in the National Post of Canada in the 80s and the 90s, and my view hasn't changed. And this idea that the central lie is that by bringing China into the global economic system, we would make China more like us. And as I've been saying now forever and ever, instead, we've become more like them. Just look at it. We had the hideous spectacle of the foreign minister of Canada not being able in interview to bring himself to utter the word Taiwan because he knew it would upset his Chinese puppet masters. This is horrible. This is horrible. And it's much more of an existential threat to the West than Russia was, because again, to use a line I've been using for 30 years, we've helped China come up with the only economically viable form of communism. We are in a very strange moment right now. Let's just put aside the arguments over the virus and the lockdown and the virus. If you take seriously the proposals coming out of Western governments, then the new normal is going to be extremely abnormal. Whole sectors are going to disappear. For example, the United Kingdom, the airline industry is up in arms because they're going to require quarantine. And this isn't now for 2 weeks or a month or anything. We're now 3 months into this thing. They're going to require quarantine now and forever of 14 days for anybody entering the United Kingdom. And if you think about it, certain airlines like Ryanair, everyone thinks it's very odd to go on a thing called Ryanair. I think it was founded by a guy called Ryan. That's why it's called Ryanair. May in fact be two guys called Ryan, as I recall. But they founded their own airline called Ryanair. And the whole premise of it is you can fly for 15 quid to Mykonos. And the only thing is the cab ride to the airport will cost more than the flight from Luton or wherever to Mykonos, and you're wedged in there and you're flying for 15 quid to the Greek islands to get pissed and have a shagadelic time. That's their business model. And so if you say to them, oh, now you've got to socially distance yourself, so there's only going to be one person in every three seats, that business model doesn't work for them. The airline industry in terms of being able to fly anywhere, as opposed to just from New York to London, is going to be completely clobbered. The tourism industry is going to be completely clobbered. The movie industry, the theatre industry, the live sports industry, all going to be totally permanently clobbered by the so-called lockdown easing rules. You're just not going to be able to, you won't be able to make money on those things, or not the kind of money these people are used to making. And that in itself is interesting, because since we gave China a monopoly on global manufacturing, so since we allowed China to make everything, what we've done is basically retail. What we're left with is retail and entertainment. So we're left with dining. We're left with shops. In shops, you can't have more than two people in the shop at any one time right now. And there again, how's the old COVID mitigation going to apply? We're going to apply when you go into Ann Taylor in Midtown Manhattan and you want to try on a skirt that's been tried on by nine other people in the last couple of days. How's that going to work? So, having given manufacturing to China. Oh, my God. Having given manufacturing to China, the scraps they've left us with, retail and entertainment and dining, have now been totaled. Tourism, air travel. And right now, 99% of air travel has collapsed. There's a route, it's not a particularly a problem for anyone apart from me and a few others, but I used to like flying Air Canada Montreal to Geneva. It's not one of their big routes. There's no reason to think it would ever be a big route, but they had so many other routes that it was worth having that as a secondary route. That's gone now. That's not going to be coming back. That's gone. It's not just our reaction to the disease, and it's not just the lockdown. It's that the new normal is actually going to specifically target the scraps of the economy that China, having swallowed manufacturing, was kind enough to leave us with. And I don't know why we would not. Why do they have a long-term global strategy, and the decadent half-wits who purport to be the elites of the Western world do not? It is bizarre to me, and it's not going to get any. It's not going to get any better. Not going to get any better at all. Esty from The Schwa writes, you know what that is. Non-Canadians won't, but it doesn't matter. Hi, Mark. I agree it would have been great if you had done the club years ago. I'm wondering what you think will come of Joe Biden. Will he continue to get the ongoing kid glove treatment from the press in spite of the Tara Reid incident, which he clearly, quote, experienced differently, a la Justin Little Potato Trudeau? Will only women who allege untoward interactions with right politicians ever be the ones who deserve to be heard? I do believe in due process, but why is there so much projection and gaslighting from the left? Since Joe Biden is clearly no longer fit, do you think he will choose one of Hillary Clinton or Michelle Obama as his running mate? And if yes, which one is your money on? In general, I'm immensely disillusioned with the lack of curiosity of the press in doing any kind of investigative work at all. Justin Trudeau should never have been elected in the first place. Thank you for upping the ante with the club and putting out all the additional content. All the best from my corner of the real Canada, Esty from The Schwa. Esty, look, the point about Justin Trudeau is you didn't have to do any investigative work. He's there actually on tape doing his banana boat song, fully blacked up, and not just in blackface, as we say, of dear old Al Jolson, but black hands, black. He's got torn jeans on, and he's blacked under his legs. So it's hard to imagine that anything that he hasn't. And the interesting thing to me was the first thing that happened was all the commentators rushed to say that this didn't mean Justin Trudeau was racist. Why would they say that? How do they know? If I were to be caught on video from the beginning of the second decade of the third millennium in blackface, people would have no fear about saying this proves I'm racist. Why isn't Justin Trudeau racist? I think he's racist. I think he suddenly believes in racist stereotypes about the spectacular endowments of the black male, which is why he's got a banana shoved down his pants, because I don't believe that's his own banana. But there's no pretense that this is even equal. There's no pretense. Now, what we have here with Joe Biden is we have more and more credible evidence that Tara Reid's account, and it's circumstantial evidence, but it's contemporaneous evidence that Tara Reid's account of what happened is as she described it. There's no countervailing narrative from Joe Biden, none at all. And in that sense, it's not a he said, she said thing, because he hasn't actually said anything. And yet they've agreed, they basically agreed not to talk about it, not to talk about it. There's not even the slightest pretense here. The only way they even tiptoe up to the pretense is that there was Mika Brzezinski did an interview with Joe Biden the other day. In the days beforehand, the story had only been covered by, grappling with. Suddenly there were all these headlines about grappling with the Biden accusations. Because it's difficult. It's very difficult, apparently, to come up with a way of confronting Joe Biden with these Tara Reid allegations. Nobody grappled with the Kavanaugh thing, no matter, even when they were Avenatti's thing, the stupid stuff about Kavanaugh being the leader of this gang rape group in high school who went around spiking the punch and then raping these girls from Avenatti. Avenatti, Michael Avenatti, the creepy porn lawyer. They didn't grapple. I'm grappling with. Wrestling. They used to, I remember once being a thing with Mrs. Thatcher, and this thing came up with me and Digby Anderson, somebody else, and one of these sort of anguished, slightly wet Tories said, conservatives are wrestling with how to process this. And Mrs. Thatcher turned to the guy and said, for heaven's sake, conservatives don't wrestle. But the Democrats are not wrestling. They're grappling with the difficulties of processing. It's the same way as with the Justin Trudeau blackface stuff. When it broke, we moved into, for a couple of hours, there was actual coverage of what the thing was. Here he is, mammy! He's going around the country going, mammy! He's covered in blackface, but he doesn't know where his face ends, so he's also gone right down his chest to his private parts. Mammy! And for a couple of hours, that was what it was on the CBC. And then by the evening, by the time Rosie Barton, Canadians don't know Rosie Barton, but don't bother with it. And because I think actually she's not hosting that show anymore, but then by the time of the national newscast that evening, Rosie had assembled her panel and she was saying, so what do liberals need to do to move on from this now? Well, pardon me, hold up just a minute. Could we just enjoy the mammy singer's performance while he's still singing mammy and wait till he's finished singing mammy before we move on to, what do liberals need to do to move on from this now? Some of us haven't moved on yet. Imagine if they'd done that with Kavanaugh. Kavanaugh's being accused of spiking the punch and being a gang rapist. What do Republicans need to do to move on from these accusations now? How come that way? So it's the same thing. What do Democrats, what does the Biden campaign need to do to put Tara Reid behind them? Maybe she shouldn't actually be put behind them. Maybe what she's... And for what it's worth, anyone who knows what the Senate was like at that point will find this behavior incredibly believable, because it was the era of the waitress sandwich, which was Ted Kennedy and the guy from Connecticut with a waitress between them. I don't even want to think about that. That's how they looked on women. That's how the old boys club looked on women. So I find this incredibly credible. And given that it didn't happen when Joe Biden was in high school or when he was a lifeguard threatening corn pop, but it happened when he was a United States senator, and it goes to his understanding of power, I'd like to hear a little bit more about it. And I think it should be taken. I think it should be taken seriously. We have a couple. We got some more Biden stuff we might share. We got a question from John Bruce. John Bruce says, I wanted to get your comment on what I think of the two most important smoking guns revealed this week on the Russia hoax. The Russia hoax is this Michael Flynn thing. The case has finally disappeared. The Department of Justice basically turned on a dime and moved to dismiss with prejudice their case against him after 3 years. John Bruce says, Flynn never actually denied speaking to Russian Ambassador Kislyak about the sanctions. The original FBI 302, before Strzok and Page revised it, said Flynn stated it was possible that he talked to Kislyak on the issue of sanctions, but if he did, he did not remember doing so. In a prosecution for lying to the FBI, the 302 is as important as the murder weapon in a homicide case. This would appear to be tampering with the evidence. During the Mueller investigation, the accusation that was the surest way to get you called a crazy conspiracy theorist was to question the notion that the Russians hacked the DNC server to obtain the emails that WikiLeaks ultimately released. Now we know that the president of CrowdStrike testified in December 2017 to the House Intel Committee that CrowdStrike had only indicators and circumstantial evidence that the Russians did it, and that they did not even have concrete evidence that the data was exfiltrated rather than downloaded by an insider. This casts grave doubt on the centerpiece of alleged Russian meddling in the 2016 election. We know there was no Trump collusion, but maybe there wasn't even much Russian meddling on which to collude. These are two very important points, John. For a start, Obama disgracefully today, and he was the one who wanted to get Flynn, by the way, Obama, the former president of the United States. So he actually weighed in on the collapse of the Department of Justice's case. And he said today something like he didn't know of anything where someone just was allowed to get away with perjury. You bloody stupid, contemptible twerp, Obama. We all know this isn't. I know from perjury because some twit from CRTV in my case perjured himself on the stand as the judge found. So I know from perjury. He's still employed by that crappy network. I know a little bit about perjury. This isn't perjury. Bill Barr actually addressed this, and it was quite correct that he said Flynn stated that it was possible that he talked to Russian Ambassador Kislyak. For a start, he's the incoming, just to explain it in legal and constitutional terms. And as you know, I'm pretty bloody sick of this joke transition, 3 month transition. As I said, the United States keeps going on about every time we have one of these elections. We're the only country that has a peaceful transfer of power. No, you're not. The United States is actually the country in the free world that takes the longest to respect the results of an election. There's no reason why 2 months after an election that Obama appointees should still be making policy in the federal government. It's stupid. And in this case, it was worse than stupid. It was wicked because the outgoing administration used those 3 months to screw the incoming administration. And one way they did so it's accepted that the incoming administration's appointees, as part of incoming, are allowed to sort of gradually immerse themselves in their job and start doing their job. And in the case of the National Security Advisor to the president, that allows him to make contacts with foreign governments for the purposes of talking about the areas for which he's responsible in dealing with those governments. So there's nothing wrong with Flynn talking to Kislyak. There's nothing wrong with Flynn talking to Kislyak on the issue of sanctions. There's no crime there. He was asked whether he talked to Kislyak about sanctions, and he said that it was possible, but if he did, he couldn't remember doing it or what he said. Now, at the time they asked that, these guys, and remember, this wasn't a conversation with lawyers present or where he was under oath or any of the other lies that the boobs, that the, sorry, getting so carried away there, nearly tipped the furniture over, that the boobs on MSNBC and everything say, They seem to think he shouldn't have been talking to the Russian ambassador. He's allowed to talk to the Russian ambassador. Is he allowed to talk to the Russian ambassador about the issue of sanctions? Yes. In fact, he was saying he wasn't planning on changing the Obama administration's line on sanctions. All he did was fail to remember, and he actually said, he put it in these terms. He didn't tell a lie. He said, I may have spoken to the Russian ambassador about sanctions, but if so, I can't remember whether I did or not, or what it was I said to him. And given that speaking to the Russian ambassador about sanctions wasn't a crime, but is, in fact, if we're going to have this stupid and insane, and by the way, this is where I part company with the constitutional fetishists. The Mark Levin types who think that this constitution came fully formed from the head of Zeus and therefore it's the greatest thing in the world and we can't. That actually prevents us looking sanely at what's going on here. Over the course of 2.5 centuries, things get perverted in fairly obvious ways. So we have the perversion now of this transition period. And in this case, a perversion that enabled a coup. And the constitutional fetishists at some point actually have to be able to talk about that too. What's the best way of doing it? Just take Michelle Obama or Joe Biden's or Hillary Clinton's or Oprah Winfrey's word that the next time there's a transition from a Democrat to a Republican, they're really promise squeaky clean they're not going to do anything about it, or actually try and end the stupid bloody thing, because the crime that happened in November, December 2016, January 2017 was highly predictable. It would be asking too much of corrupt politicians not to do it. And in that case, this is what happened. But that's all. When Obama says that Flynn committed perjury, here's what Flynn was asked. Do you remember talking to the Russian ambassador Kislyak about sanctions? Flynn said, I may have spoken to him about sanctions, but to be honest, I don't remember. That was actually a correct answer. I talked to all kinds of people about all kinds of things, day in, day out, week in, week out. And if you ask me about a conversation I'd had 6 weeks earlier, whether we brought up this subject or that subject, I might remember or might not. For that answer, that single answer, this man's life was ruined. Now, there was no probable cause. There was no underlying crime. Speaking to the Russian ambassador about sanctions wasn't a crime. So we have here a basic malicious prosecution case. We shouldn't have to have malicious prosecution if you just had, again, as you do in the rest of the common law world, that costs follow the event, as the judge ordered in the British Columbia case brought by Michael Mann. Michael Mann's case was dismissed with prejudice. He lost. Therefore, Tim Ball won. Therefore, Tim Ball has his costs paid by Michael Mann. In this case, it should be that simple. The United States Department of Justice withdrew its crappy case with prejudice. They lost. Flynn won. And they should pay him. Instead, he has to go through the trouble now of filing a malicious prosecution suit. He has all the elements. And again, for reasons I don't want to go into, but I know a little bit about malicious prosecution in various jurisdictions, including at the federal level. And malicious prosecution, this meets all the elements under whichever section of the United States Code it is, which means you have to have been prosecuted for a criminal offence. Flynn was. It has to have been instigated without probable cause. The Department of Justice's brief just filed actually pretty much concedes it was without probable cause. The government itself admits that. With malice. Again, the government comes close to saying it proceeded with malice, in that they knew, they were well aware at the time they charged Flynn and that they entrapped Flynn, was that they knew they had no case against him. Under a valid warrant, accusation or summons, yes, which has terminated favourably to the plaintiff, it's terminated favourably, it's been dismissed with prejudice and it has damaged the plaintiff. They're the elements, whatever that, how many was that, six? They're the elements you need for a successful malicious prosecution claim under federal law, and he's pretty much got them, and because of the prominence of the case, he ought to be getting 30, 40, 60, 70, $187 bazillion out of it. I don't know whether he'll do that, but he should do that. And to hear idiots like, to hear Obama weighing in on this, you know, Obama actually could be named in a malicious prosecution case for this, which may be why he's doing that. And that, John, is a very good point. Owen Morgan actually says, now that General Flynn has seen the charges against him dropped, charges will finally have to be brought against those who conspired to get him wrongfully convicted, won't they? Or am I missing something? Well, as I said, I think Bill Barr has actually indicated he's probably not going to do that for reasons of internal peace within the Department of Justice. I think that's the wrong decision, but he's sort of hinted, unless he's kind of lowering expectations before lowering the boom, he's kind of hinted that he will not be going there. But I certainly think a malicious prosecution case, they're difficult to bring in America because of this cost, because uniquely in the common law world, costs don't follow the event. We have this situation where you have to file these malicious prosecution cases. And, you know, if I was in Flynn's situation, I'd be exhausted. Maybe I'd just want to go to the Cook Islands for a couple of years and not even think about Washington. You don't know. People react to these things differently. Let's see what other interesting questions we have here. King K says, Mark, I used to adhere to the notion that our system was the worst one except for all of the others and take some comfort in that. That doesn't seem to cut it anymore. Largely, but not entirely, from reading your work for several years, I've begun to believe that we need a totally new social contract in the US and the West in general, an entirely new conception of government. I accept the traditional American Western view that government is necessary, but a necessary evil. The problem is that lately it is trending more evil than not. A few things come to mind. The COVID shutdown makes clear that state governors and city mayors should not have authority to declare emergencies and seize dictatorial powers. Perhaps we should do away with the one-person executive altogether, and certainly our judicial and regulatory systems need serious reforms. But I'm thinking about things more sweeping than all of these. The main goal would be to greatly lessen the discretionary authority of individuals, which seems most often to be exercised out of pure officiousness. It seems like pie in the sky, I know, but I'm wondering if you have any ideas along these lines. Thanks, and all the best, King K. Yeah, I said I got a bit fed up with the silence of what I called constitutional fetishists about things like, obvious things like this three-month transfer of power. And I don't mean anything offensive by that term, but I think that almost all systems, all long-lasting systems of government presume the behaviour of gentlemen. And if you don't have gentlemen, it becomes, then whatever system you've got, it's really not much point. Thing is, if you've got someone prepared to, it's quite obvious, for example, you can become a governor, you can become a senator, you can become a congressman without knowing a first thing about the United States Constitution. So that only one team is playing with the rule book. That's one of the problems here. And I don't just mean by the one, only one team's playing by the rule. I don't just mean AOC and the governor of Michigan and Nancy Pelosi and whoever, but I mean that most of their voters are not constitutionalists in any meaningful sense. They'll deploy it when it's useful. They'll say, well, our sworn constitutional duty demands that we impeach Trump. They'll play the constitutional card when it suits them, but it has no purchase on them or their supporters, which I in itself I find interesting. Now, all systems come and go. We may be coming to, looked for a while as if we were coming to the end of the Westphalian era of nation states as the organizing principle of the world order. If you go back, we've all been doing these comparisons between COVID-19 and the Spanish flu. If you go back I'll give you another example before we go to that specifically. The paradigm of the division of the world into left and right, which has prevailed more or less since the French Revolution. I suggested, actually, I think rather casually, on an after the show with Ainsley and Pete Hegseth and my compatriot Janice Dean on Fox and Friends, that we were actually coming to the end of that, that we were seeing the first big shift in that. So that, for example, you see in Europe, particularly the emergence of parties that are what one might call fiscally liberal but culturally conservative. Trump himself is a phenomenon of that. He, as we've seen in the multi-trillion dollar spending of the last few weeks, he's not really interested particularly in fiscally conservative. He believes in energy in the executive before you do the bean counting. And he is a culturally conservative figure. So the old divisions of left and right, you know, Milton Friedman, I don't get the feeling that he's talking about Milton Friedman a lot or reading Milton Friedman a lot. So we have, wherein, if that trend were to continue, that would be a significant bust up after best part of 2.5 centuries in the way we've been looking at these things. Then we've been talking about this comparison between COVID-19 and the Spanish flu. And if you go back to the Spanish flu at the end of the Great War, that was also the end of the Age of Empires, basically, 100 years ago, because there'd been the Great War and huge numbers of people had been slaughtered and still wound up losing the war. And so people said, well, why do we have to go back to the Habsburgs? And why do we have to go back to the Hohenzollerns? And why do we have to go back to the Romanovs? What the hell have they done for us? Then comes, just to seal that deal, then along comes the Spanish flu. And so the argument for the Age of Kings is that the king is a paternalist creature and will take care of you. And when the king fails to take care of you, you rightly conclude, who needs the king? Let's get rid of him. That's what happened to the Habsburgs and the Hohenzollerns and the Romanovs. Not just because of the Great War, but also in part because of the Spanish flu that followed. We're now moving from the democratic era into the post-democratic era. And I think it's interesting the way we are being asked to essentially for democratically elected leaders to step aside in a crisis and mortgage the nation to the technocrat experts. We see that, we saw that at the beginning in the United States when Trump stepped aside and Dr. Fauci became the most important man in America. And we saw a similar thing in the United Kingdom with this guy, Neil Ferguson, the guy who was having the lockdown leg over with his married lady friend in an open relationship. And we saw something similar in Canada with Dr. Theresa Tam, whose only problem is that she was a little too obviously just the creature of China. But this, what's disturbing about this is that the media and the left are talking ever more openly of contempt for self-government, of the idea that people are allowed to choose their own leaders, and then those leaders are allowed to enact their own policy. So, for example, you can elect a guy like Trump. And if you're stupid enough to do that, then it is necessary for him not to be able to impact at any kind, in any way whatsoever, Ukrainian policy. That should just be left to the so-called experts, the career bureaucrats. And likewise, a great global pandemic, that should just be left to the experts, the career bureaucrats. And you wind up with the world we're in. We are now in an extraordinary an unprecedented situation in which public health bureaucrats have shut down the entire global economy. They've shut down entire sectors of that economy to the point that they may never be coming back. And so whatever that is, it's not self-government by, of, and for the people, is it? It's something different. It's a permanent cast of experts who know what's best for us. And with the odd exception of Sweden, remarkably, all these so-called global health technocrats all seem, in whatever country it is, all seem to agree on what needs to be done, which is yet another reason why their word cannot be contested. Which, again, is the absolute... If we go back 100 years... to the Wilsonian principles of self-determination. He didn't like the Habsburg Empire because it contained all kinds of different people. It contained Austrians, Hungarians, Slovenes, Bohemians, and the Slovene way of doing things might be different from the Hungarian way of doing things, so why should they all be in the same empire together? There's none of that now. It's like if the elites in all countries agree, then different cultural differences between this or that group, between, say, Canadians and Germans or Germans and Brazilians, all these things don't matter any longer. There is a, it's rather like the global warming graph. One of the things that interests me about Michael Mann's global warming graph is that because it averages out all the temperatures of the entire planet, what it actually is a graph of a climate no society in human history has actually lived under. Nobody actually lived under that hockey stick, even if you believe it, because it's just taken a global climate and imposed that global climate on the planet. And as we know, there's no such thing, because like when it's summer in the northern hemisphere, it's winter in the southern hemisphere and so on. But it says this is the only thing that matters. Likewise, we now have global wisdom. The fact that all the public health employees agree is why they know better than locally elected politicians. It's an extraordinary... it's actually an extraordinary transformation just in recent years. Wanda Sherratt writes, Wanda says, does it seem to you that the present commemoration of the end of World War II is morphing into a celebration of the Wu flu panic, even as the real war is being airbrushed out of the picture? People are being encouraged to think of themselves as plucky yeomen enduring the Blitz. We'll meet again is being co-opted into an anthem for straight-jacketed civilians. I think that's the Queen who's to blame for that, Wanda. She said that at the end of her message a couple of weeks back. We will meet again. And instead of the few, we have nurses and store clerks turned into ersatz heroes. Clap for the NHS is straight out of the wartime propaganda playbook, though to me it seems like a secular revival of Evensong for the deracinated. How long before there are posters up warning against enemy spies and encouraging people to be on the lookout for saboteurs? Yes, it is... it's kind of sad and desperate, that the need for myth-making about the lockdown, which has peculiarly been happening in the United Kingdom. Again, I think that's actually quite an interesting point, that in the United States, there's no doubt from the word go, there were people, large numbers of people, chafing against the lockdown. They really didn't like it. And then you had other countries, which I think is truer of parts of continental Europe, where they didn't mind it for 15 days. And they kind of put up with it for a week or two after that. But by then they were sick of it. What's interesting is in the United Kingdom in particular, they seem to have accepted the lockdown. And that's kind of bizarre. And they're happy to go along with things like this Thursday night clap for the NHS thing, which again is bizarre. Do you remember that thing? I think it's in my book, After America, where they were complaining that the United Kingdom had no equivalent of July the 4th. And so there was talk about making the founding of the NHS, which as it happens is July the 5th, the national holiday. So on July the 4th, Americans would celebrate Independence Day, and on July the 5th, the United Kingdom would celebrate Dependence Day. I don't know how you can take part in these secular ceremonies without understanding that in part a great nation is now living on fumes, and that it's kind of pitiful. And I don't wish to single out Britain in this, because I think you can say the same. It goes back to VE Day and all the other anniversaries we're marking at the moment, but that these, that something is coming to an end. This is not the normal behavior of self-regenerating societies. That it's some kind of pitiful stage, and when a pitiful transitional stage at the end of which something else will arise. And it's hard to look at what's happened, particularly in somewhere like Britain, without thinking that is the case. I'm struggling to put that into words without just being too bleak about it. I mentioned the Emperor Franz Joseph, and the Queen, as you know, I often talk about Radetzky March, which is a great novel about the Habsburg twilight, and the sense that everybody in Vienna knows the whole thing is not going to long outlast him. And as admirable as the Queen's messages on the pandemic and VE Day have been, there is the sense of the old nonagenarian queen sitting there in Windsor Castle, and whether this whole system outlasts her or whether it's not hard to discern when something is coming to an end. I'll leave it at that, because it really does demand a Radetzky March type treatment. Beth writes, "Dear Mark, joining the Mark Stein Club 3 years ago was one of the best decisions I've ever made. The quality and the volume of the content you make available to us is incredible. I don't know how you do it. I've always loved the Mark Stein Show and appreciate your bringing us unique voices and perspectives. But during this crisis, it's even more valuable, not just as an enjoyable and informative program, but by your conveying the truth in an often humorous way, keeping us sane. Tales for Our Time brings to the forefront important and often neglected works of literature. I love the Sunday poem. I can't thank you enough." Thank you, Beth. Thank you. I do. Oh, Beth adds about the cruise. "While I miss this year's cruise, I greatly enjoyed the last two. Perhaps we can schedule it for next year. It was a wonderful itinerary. Or if we want to be on land, how about taking over some hotel in Italy or Switzerland? I've never been to mainland Britain, that is outside Britain and Ireland, and would love to go." Britain's withdrawn from the EU now, so it's Britain and Europe. You don't have to say mainland Europe anymore. And if you're in Belfast and you talk about the mainland, meaning that means Britain, at least to a loyalist. If you say it to a Republican, they get annoyed at the... there's a whole riff to be done, or actually in terms of Britain and Ireland, on the offensiveness of certain... the offensiveness of names and terms. They made it at the BBC once. They made us all go to a meeting about it and told us which terms we could... there was a whole list of terms we weren't meant to use. They were all the terms we did use, and then they didn't tell us any terms we could use. But I remember mainland being, well, I might revive that, because it was a it was a funny moment in BBC bureaucratic terms. Anyway, I forgot what I was saying now. Well, we may do that thing. We may do it on land, Beth. I'm not sure. That's the thing about, we have members all over the world. And the horrible thing now is, whatever passport, depending on what passport you carry, different places in the world all have different rules now for letting you in. Some might let you in. Some might let you in if you are willing to quarantine for 14 days. And some might not let you in at all. So that whole thing has been totaled. Because our governments did not act responsibly in January, by the time they roused themselves to act in March, they'd screwed the planet. That's basically the story of what happened here. And it's going to be years for us to recover from their inactivity between January and March. And there's blame enough to go around all kinds of people, certainly to the public health establishment, corrupted by China. And then you had national public health officials like Fauci, corrupted by the WHO, and on and on. But the inaction between January and March, we will be living with the consequences of that for years. Anyway, Beth's main point, sorry to be a while getting to it, is Beth's main point is it seems to me that this crisis is creating an almost Soviet style of community. I'm not talking about the lines outside stores where it's impossible to buy toilet paper. I'm talking about the neighbor ratting out neighbor behavior, with the scolds taking to sites like next door to shame those who want to walk outside in the sun without masks, or chastising those who want the government to open the 72 miles of beaches we have here. I do not minimize the devastation of this virus, but we should be allowed to discuss how it is transmitted and the appropriate use of masks without becoming pariahs in our community. The masks thing is a particularly idiotic problem, Beth, because, you know, the government itself has completely turned around its views on, oh, no, 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 you don't need masks. Oh, no, no, only health workers need masks. No, 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 you don't need to bother with masks. Stop with the hoarding with the masks. Stop going on Amazon and buying masks. You don't need masks. Oh, wait a minute, now you can't go outside without a mask. That's the government. So if the government can have completely different views on it, there's no reason why you can't. The Stasi thing. The urge to rat out your neighbour, it used to be absolutely it was the one thing, I wrote about this at one point, I think I mentioned it somewhere or other along the way. I made a film in Hungary just after the fall of the Iron Curtain. It was a co-production between the BBC and MTV, which isn't the rock video guys, but Magyar Television, Hungarian television. And it was very interesting because we just kept going from every guy we saw, the next guy we saw said the previous guy we saw had been a state informant. And the BBC guys, who were all lefties to a man, felt very queasy at the whole idea of ratting out, which was the organizational principle of the Soviet satellite states, that you kept yourself safe by ratting out your neighbors and your friends and your family, if necessary, your parents and your children or your spouse. And it is slightly weird to see how eagerly we have all taken to that under the name of public health. It is one of the most bizarre and repellent aspects of what's been going on the last few weeks, Beth. Now, where's this? Here it is, I think. George Pazin. I think I called him George Pazin the first time. I saw some correspondence from George, and he politely corrected me and said it was George Pazin, not Georges Pazin. But I quite like Georges Pazin. Anyway, Monsieur Pazin, or Mr. Pazin, says, question, what do you think of Sweden and its decision to not lock down? It's Sweden is the only bastion of individual liberty left right now. Which I think is a bit surprising, because it's a statist socialist utopia, and even Swedes are regarded as crazy, even by the other Scandinavians. In other words, no matter how nutty you might think Finns and Norwegians and Danes are, they think Swedes are even crazier. It has a monolithically left-wing press. And yet it is doing something quite surprising. It decided that to mitigate the disease, it would leave it to the people to decide what to do, how to mitigate it. So they've recommended social distancing and all the other stuff, but they haven't had wanker coppers out on the street enforcing it. And the net result of having nothing, in effect, having no mandatory lockdown, having restaurants open where people are still in there convivially having drinks and all the rest of it, what's the upshot of that? Well, they have a lower rate of deaths per capita than Belgium, Spain, Italy, the UK, France. In other words, the UK and France are in total, and Spain and Italy are in total lockdown, and Sweden is open and has actually managed to have a lower rate of death per capita. And people say, why is that? And I saw my old boss, Charles Moore, in The Spectator this week arguing that it's because people don't have the same population density in Sweden as the United Kingdom. I don't think that's anything to do with it. With respect to Charles, who was right about an awful lot. But, for example, in Sweden, most people live in large cities. If you even go to quaint country towns, that's one of the interesting things about this is that if you go to like small Swedish country towns, little country towns with a couple of thousand people in them, maybe less than that, maybe just 800 people in them, the people in that little country village are still living in a maybe two or three story apartment house where they're living in a three-room apartment in the middle of a village, in the middle of 100 miles of wood either side of it. That's the way the Swedes live. Generally speaking, one of the reasons why lockdown, one would have thought, would be incredibly tough on a lot of European countries is because they depend so much on the public space, on the public square. If you go to German towns, a lot of people living in apartment houses around a nice little patch of green, little green square in the middle with a little park and some swings and things on it. So much of life, if you live in small apartments in continental towns, takes place in the public square. You would have thought these people would have been driven nuts by the lockdown long before Americans, where American towns far more spread out, far more subdivisions with, you know, three-bedroom houses on a nice-sized lot. People who in continental countries would be living in apartment houses are instead living actually quite spread out lives, and yet they're the ones who found the lockdown harder to take far quicker than the Germans or the Spaniards or the Italians. So I don't believe it's the population density thing, given the way the Swedish population is much more concentrated into towns and cities. And I would have thought it was more likely to be simply social customs. You know, the Spaniards and the Italians are far more gregarious. They're hugging and a-kissing each other all the time. If you go to France, you know, the women like the three-kiss thing, the one side, the other side, back to the original side, you know. And the Swedes, the Swedish blondes, one of the reasons for their appeal is it's a cool glamour. It's a distant glamour. There's less of that. And I mentioned the other day on Rush the Jonathan Kay article. Jonathan Kay was briefly my editor at the National Post of Canada and made one of the worst editing mistakes I've ever known, and I've never forgiven for him. He's very unreliable. He was rather, in fact, unpleasant during the CRTV business, all this. So I got no use for Jonathan. His mum's delightful, delightful lady, but Jonathan, I've always been wary of, and he has an interesting piece in Quillette about looking at these microcultural differences. He's taken all the super spreader events and tried to figure out what things are caused in common. And he said, for example, that, you know, baying the national anthem at a certain kind of sporting event, where, and there's all this saliva flying through the air, you're more likely to get super spreader events there than at certain other kinds of sporting events. He's done what I'm surprised nobody else has done. And he's actually tried to focus in on why things have happened here but not there. For example, all the movie houses are closed, but there's no evidence that movies actually spread this thing. Because, as I said on Rush, Most of the time, you're just sort of sitting there slack-jawed in front of some tedious chick flick or some CGI battle scene or whatever it was. Perhaps if there were some genuinely funny comedy, there'd be lots of saliva spraying around. But in fact, Hollywood can't make genuinely funny comedies anymore, so that's not a problem. Again, with all those national anthem baying at certain kinds of sports events, maybe you'd be better, instead of going to hockey or to whatever, instead just going to a nice, quiet cricket match where you applaud politely and then go off to the tea pavilion. I don't understand why we don't have any of this information yet. But one of the things that I do find interesting is that we do have different social norms in places. And it may well be that just the different cultural norms between Scandinavia and the Mediterranean come into play at a time like this. Trevor Phillips in the UK tried, he's black, so he can do it. If you're a white guy, don't go near this kind of topic. But he was trying to explain why blacks had been clobbered by it, but Muslims aren't. Well, half the Muslim population is basically kept inside all day long, and if they do leave the house, they're basically wearing the full head-to-toe mask, so they're a lot safer than most people. But then they also ritually wash five times a day. We ought to know 3 months in why there are these differences. But the Swedish thing is a challenge, because they've just gone about their business. They've got a lower death per capita rate than Britain, France, Belgium, whatever, and they still have their lives. And that's just to come back to this point. I don't understand why we still know so little about it, what is going on. Thank you so much for all your questions. I'll try and pick up some. It's been, as you can probably tell, there's been a few technical difficulties at this end that have made it difficult. Jessica says, just a quick thing from Jessica, we love everything about the Mark Steyn Club. Thank you, Jessica. You don't have to like everything. Tell me things you don't like, too. But Jessica adds, Tales for Our Time is one of our favourites. We've got a new one of those coming up. The Coronacopia Steyn shows are a staple of our lockdown routine, and we look forward to everyone. One thing we feel that's missing is a podcast. I forward as many articles as I can to our kids, but I know they would prefer a podcast. Is that something you would consider in the future? Our shows, we've decided with both Tales for Our Time and the Mark Steyn Show to make them sort of accessible. I don't know what I'm talking about here, so feel free to ignore it. But via RSS feed and podcast feeds that you can access in your motor vehicle or your telephone or whatever. So we've done a little bit to sort of meet you halfway on that, Jessica. And I hope that makes it easier for your kids. And I thank you very much for all your kindly renewals these last couple of days. It means a lot to me, particularly at this difficult time. As I said, the big thing here is that the Chinese took our manufacturing and they left us with retail and tourism and entertainment. They left us, in other words, with three or four boutique parts of the economy that have all just been totaled by this COVID-19, and there's no sign of when any of them are going to be back or how they're going to be back. And again, that's what makes it worth it. Even if you don't think that China invented this virus in a lab, the fact is, when you look at its impact, if they had invented it in a lab, they wouldn't have done anything differently. We have our Mother's Day special coming up in a few hours, I think. Early hours of Sunday morning. And before that, Kathy Shadle will be here with her weekend movie date. And I will be back with our Song of the Week tomorrow, Sunday, and a brand new Mark Steyn Show Monday morning. And I hope you'll join me then. That's it for now. I promise we will be back next time to our regular live format. We will see you then.